Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is filmmaker Jed Shepherd. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Now, just to give people some context, and just because it's so, I guess, so close to the date of when I saw you and now we're talking. So 2 days ago, there was the first University of Greenwich screening with Q&A, and your film Host was playing, and Pranal Bailey Bond did a Q&A with you, which was a really interesting session.
How lucky am I to have a master filmmaker like Prano ask me the questions? you know, for when Censor came out, I think I interviewed her about five times because there's not that many kind of horror films that have kind of broken out over the last few years. I was the go-to person. So, and everyone thought I was, like they were the only ones to ask me to interview Prano, but it ended up being everyone asking me. So I felt like I saw Censor more times than I saw Host in the last few years, but I love Censor, so that's fine.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, it's a great film. Yeah. And for me, it was the first time seeing Host on the big screen, and it was first time I'd seen it since I'd watched it in lockdown when it first hit Shudder. So it's kind it was kind of like, you know, when you've forgotten enough about a film, I mean, you've got the memory of the film, obviously, but you've forgotten enough about it that it felt like I was watching a new film again.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Because I swear, Jed, I didn't remember. I mean, I remember the woman hovering over the pool, but I didn't remember as much like creature stuff in it. I just remember, you know, and so it was great. That was all like, was all fresh again to me. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's. You know, I think because of we made it a lockdown, it came out of lockdown, and most people watched it in lockdown. Those kind of memories have been kind of pushed back into the archives of the mind. So and watching it on the big screen is a whole different vibe. It's people don't realize how cinematic it actually is, even though it's over Zoom. Like some of the stuff we managed to pull off. It was really interesting watching. I only came in for the last 10, 15 minutes, but it was really interesting seeing people's reactions and where people get scared, where people find it funny. I always love seeing it with a big audience.
Yeah, and I must admit, actually, that's probably the bigger thing is watching it. It's the first time I've also watched it with an audience.
Yeah.
Because I did watch it on my own, and while that is fun to watch films on your own, there is something else that happens to the magic of a movie when you're in the room. Even if you're not having the same reaction, it's entertaining on a different level when people are reacting to the film. And clearly there was people in there who'd not seen it who were seeing it for the first time. And when they were jumping, it was as entertaining as the film, you know, just to be in that kind of moment.
Yeah, there was a lady behind me who she said something along the lines of, I thought that was going to be shit. But it wasn't. It was good because she must have been dragged there by a friend or something who said, "Oh yeah, it's like this Zoom movie." So this lady probably was like, "This is going to be nonsense, low budget nonsense." It's low budget, but it definitely isn't nonsense. It's it's just entertaining, and you know, I still get things out of watching it too. I've watched it a million times, but like I still find it fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the thing, seeing it on the big screen compared to not, was I'd not really made the comparison with, say, something like It Follows, in the way that you're watching more than just the actors. You're watching the whole screen. You're waiting. Mm-hmm. You've primed us by about 15 minutes into the seance to be looking for everything, not just what the people are doing, which obviously most film is about who's the subject and what are they doing? What's their point of view and why are they bothered? Whereas suddenly you're going, all bets are off.
Yeah.
The whole screen you've got to look at.
You have to, you know, you could watch that movie, and I wish we had the foresight to do this. There should be an option where you could just pick one of the cast just to follow the entire time and just watch her window, because there's stuff going on everywhere, and like each has their own kind of journey throughout the entire film. I mean, Emma has probably the craziest journey because she sees the most stuff, but it's the stuff I notice every time I watch it, just reactions from the cast. And I say the cast, they're just my mates. I was literally just speaking to Emma just now. She'd just done an audition for some big show, and she sent me some very filtered pictures to look at. it's fun. It's a fun film, and I love watching it.
We're going to talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. But before we do, I'd like to continue some of the conversation you were having with Prano about the process of filmmaking, in particular the writing of, because not only are you developing movies, you've also developed a game, interactive movie game? It's going to be on platforms, isn't it? It's going to be like on PSs and Xboxes and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's called Ghost. It's a live action video game. It's along the lines of this much maligned game called Night Trap, which came out on the Mega CD or Sega CD, if you're in Japan or America. And it's coming out in all formats, PS4, PS5, Steam.
Switch. So it's not a film, is what I mean. It's like because what I wanted to talk to you about is the difference between writing for film and writing for a game. With a film, we've got a clear constraint, i.e. the runtime, and that might be governed by budget, it might be governed by the producer, there's all kinds of reasons why the runtime will be determined. But with a video game, you're playing it. So the runtime isn't so much, and you can play a game for hours, and maybe never finish it.
Usually that's correct, but I also have constraints in the game as well, where the game is locked, where you can only play it at 10 p.m. It has this unique feature that no other game's ever had, where if you try to play the game at 9:59, you wouldn't be able to. And then it hits 10 p.m. and then it starts, because the conceit is you're the producer director of a TV show, like a spooky TV show, and that TV show starts at 10 p.m. So the game starts at 10 p.m. and then you find yourself in the outside broadcast van outside a haunted house with the hosts of this TV show, which are Alice Lowe and Scroobius Pip. They're introducing the show. You've got lots of stuff to do in the outside broadcast van. You have all these, a million cameras inside every room of this haunted house. And then the people turn up who are going to go into the haunted house, and it's the host girls. And they get introed, and they go in, and your job is to keep the show entertaining, make sure it doesn't get taken off the air. You also have to send Alice down the road to all the neighbors' houses to collate information. You've got all this stuff happening inside the van as well. You've got to do all this admin. It's more exciting than I'm making it sound. Then you've got the
You're forcing us to be sort of be Ghost Watch.
It's basically an interactive Ghost Watch.
Yeah, amazing.
100% is. And then you've got this big long creature called the Long Lady, who the urban legend is, if you see her face, you die. And she's skulking around in the background in places. But it's really like the slow release of information throughout the storylines. that is where you've got to get the satisfaction, because the aim is to figure out if ghosts really exist, ghosts are real, and throughout the journey you take as this producer-director, you will discover what the real story is. And my influence is, you know, Nigel Neal, old British kind of 60s and 70s kind of TV shows, and
it's interesting then that you've created constraints that don't normally exist within a video game, but certainly the difference between a video game and a film is that when I watch a film, I don't have any choices, and you as the creator get to determine the release of information, how you don't determine how I understand it, as was evidenced in the Q&A. So it was quite interesting. One of the questions you got was, what was this? And like, I'm thinking it was in the film, the answer to that. But anyway.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, when you're writing for a game where you're not you're only controlling what they can access, but you're not controlling whether they'll access it.
Yeah.
Whereas in a film, obviously you're going to show something and it's like, here's a clue.
Yeah.
This is the legend of or whatever, you know? So what's the difference in approach to developing that as a script for a game versus a script for a film?
The script of the game is a lot more complicated and layered than a film. So it's essentially potentially like writing 20 different films all concurrent with the same characters. And it's the frustrating element is you put so much work into something that probably no one will see, or very few people will see, because you've got the main storyline that you want everyone to kind of follow, but then you have to do myriad other storylines as well in case someone chooses that way. But the aim of the game is to, because you're the producer director, you have to make sure the show is entertaining as possible, because it's a failing show, it's a failing cable channel in the UK. And you see the figures of how many people are watching. If it drops out under a certain number, your show's pulled off the air. So you have to keep sending the best live feed from all the information you've got to live, basically. But you see everything. You see every room. You see, and the ladies from the cast, from hosts, they're able to go anywhere in the house and interact with each other. And when they interact with each other, you find out more things about them. There's so much going on. Like, people will be playing this game for years and years and years and years and just discover new things. And like Host or Dashcam, like, we left an element of improvisation as well. So, you know, even I wouldn't know what they'd come up with or where they would see a ghost. And obviously we rigged this house to help them see ghosts and for things to happen. So they were in the dark a lot as well. So writing it, sometimes it's what happens in the house is a surprise to me too. So I jump off from that point and write a little storyline about something that they said. It's, you know, it's a real collaborative process.
I mean, basic computer programming is usually like a flowchart of a yes, no, yes, no. And if you go no, then that begins to send you down a different route, doesn't it? And it can come back on itself, obviously, or it can find. I mean, so I could choose arguably the wrong route first, but still through other choices get back on track almost.
Yeah, that's the only possible way you're able to do it, and it fit on a Nintendo Switch cartridge. You can't just have them do absolutely anything, like decide to go to the shops and then you spend the entire game in Sainsbury's. But like, we've given you the illusion of ultimate choice.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, there is only a set number of choices you can do. But it's looking at 10 p.m. means that everyone in the country plays the game. Everyone in your time zone can play the game at the same time and experience things at the same time as you. So you can share that information with each other. And and then you've got, if you fail, then you have to wait for 24 hours so you can play it again.
You bastard.
So, you know, it's my first game. So I want it to be interesting and And the beauty is, I don't really have anyone telling me what I can and can't do. And because I've never made a game before, I don't have any rules I'm sticking by. I don't know what the rules are. I'm just like, okay, let's lock the game at 10 p.m. And everyone's like, that's not been done before. And I'm like, well, let's do it then. And there's other stuff in the game like that as well, where we've really tested the limit of what you can do. And it's really the Nintendo Switch version that's kind of caused some of the constraints, because that has the smallest amount of space on
okay.
So we've had to make it work on the Nintendo Switch, which it does. It's so cool.
Now, one last question. Thinking of the constraints that mm-hmm. you come up against,
yeah.
Could you give an example of a constraint that then led to a revelation that became good? So the constraint initially was, oh, shit. And then, but actually what the solution became was like, ah, that's enhanced the game now.
Yeah, well, it's just when the game developers say you have X amount of space left, you have to think on your feet. You can't, the game has to end at some point. Mm. There has to be an end point. It can't be an open-ended game, because we're working with linear time in theory. So, and it's a live TV show as well. That's the premise. So that's a big constraint, that it's live. You can't just go back and say, hey, 20 minutes earlier or fast forward into the future. But then it makes it feel more authentic. That's the revelation, that this feels so authentic and like you are really working on a live show. Because this outside broadcast van has all the stuff you'd have inside an outside broadcast van. You have emails you have to check. You have all these sound files. You have to deal with, you know, people coming into the outside broadcast van hassling you. There's all kinds of stuff. So it's I think it's unlike any other game that's ever been out there. And yeah, maybe nobody will ever do one again like this, because it's quite a lot of work.
Quite possibly. But also, you know, one of the complaints, certainly in the TV world, mm-hmm. is we've lost the water cooler moment, because nobody's watching that show at 8 o'clock on a Sunday night anymore, because they'll watch it whenever they damn well want, or they might mm-hmm. watch it 6 months after the fact.
Yeah.
Whereas what you're doing with this device you've created within the gameplay is mm-hmm. you've forced the thing that the internet opened up of, like, we could do everything non-linear. You've gone, hold on a minute. Yeah. I guess what you're saying is the success of Ghostwatch was mm-hmm. when them phones were ringing, people are going, oh my God, you know, there was people in the country who were seeing this for real, mm-hmm. is what made it an event. I mean, it's still enjoyable to watch after the fact, but for those, I mean, I wasn't lucky enough. For those lucky enough that sat there in 1992 and thought something had gone wrong on their telly, mm-hmm. it must have blew their tiny minds.
Exactly, yeah. And there's lots of Ghostwatch DNA, like, in this. We have a live phone number as well, but I won't say too much about that. Because, again, this is playing in real time, in real life, so phone numbers work. There's so much that leaks into real life. I don't want to spoil things, but it's, and Alice Lowe is playing Alice Lowe, and Scroobius Pip is playing Scroobius Pip.
Perfect.
It's them presenting the show.
Michael Parkinson and Sarah Green.
If I could get Michael Parkinson and Sarah Green, I definitely would have. Like, I almost, like, Yvette Fielding wanted to be in it. She was talking to me a lot. I was going to put her in. I might still put her in it somewhere. Maybe. And that's the beauty, that it's my game, and I can do what I want. And there's going to be updates as well every now and again with extra things. So, it's a real experience. But my aim for all of this is really to kind of create a universe of like, everything's connected.
Yeah.
So games, films, TV shows, comics, like, everything I do is kind of connected in some kind of way.
Thank you for sharing that. I know we're a long way. We're not like weeks before people are going to be able to see this, but thank you for sharing the process into it. Because I think that kind of, I certainly didn't appreciate that level of invention, but also the fact that you've gone, they're the rules. Okay, well, can I have this rule? And they've not said no. You've kind of been able to develop it and experiment, and then suddenly, when you say it back to me, like, what you've, the frame that you've got, it's like, wow, okay, I can see, you can see how that creates the moment.
And I think it's maybe the confidence of when Host came out. That's what I had the confidence to do something a little bit out of my area of expertise. And off the back of that, like, I've been offered other games as well, like legit famous game franchises. So it's a world that I'm going to keep playing in for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, I recently interviewed Jörg Tittell, who's got a game coming out called The Last Worker. In fact, it's the latest episode of the podcast as we speak this very second. And he's a filmmaker and he's a game designer. And he doesn't define himself as one or the other. I saw him speak at the Focus conference back in December in Islington. And he was talking about how he did like almost like a click. I think it was like a clickbait talk where it was like, games are going to save game writing is going to save cinema or something like that. It was a real sort of
wow. maybe with the advent of like VR, because I think that's the future of filmmaking.
I mean, it was like I say, it was more of a kind of to get people in the room. And then when he talked to he talked about the separate things, but I think him being a person that was involved with both was the surprise to most people in the room. And obviously, you're doing the same kind of. Crossover.
Well, just quickly, the I would say one of the problems with kind of games in the past, maybe not in the last 5 years, but in the past, is it wasn't film writers, it wasn't filmmakers write or screenwriters writing games. It was, you know, game developers essentially or game creators who don't have an experience writing film or TV or anything who would write the storyline. And you know that if you get someone who's worked with story for a little while, who know how to structure a story writing a game, then the game becomes even more rich. I feel I'm not saying that, you know, game developers can't write video games, I'm sure they can, but if you have someone whose job it is to write a story, then surely the game will have a better story in theory.
The basic notion of, you know, set up and payoff. And if you've got multiple payoffs, then you've also got to have multiple setups that...
Oh, man, there's so many payoffs. There's so many payoffs in Ghosts. There's so many. You know, a bit like Host, like you set everything up, and then slowly everything pays off. I'm excited for everyone to play it. I'm obviously playing demos to test it, and like it's really cool for me, just, again, seeing all my friends on screen. Getting into Mischief again.
Indeed. Well, we'll be excited for when that goes live. But for now, we're going to now talk about three films that have impacted everything in adult life. And for those people that don't know the format, Jed, I'm just going to, for your benefit too, as you're sat here talking to me, it's a very simple format. You've given me three films. I'll prompt you with each title, but there's a little bit of jeopardy involved. We've only got 5 minutes. And when the bell goes and you hear this sound, it's time to move on to the next film.
Okay.
does that make sense to you?
It does, yes.
The clock is ticking. I'm going to do them in the order you gave them. So, I mean, I'll prompt you. So the films you obviously love. So I don't think whatever order did them in, it wouldn't matter, I don't think.
Yeah.
But I'll do them in the order they came to me on the email. So the first one in the list is 1984's Night of the Comet. Do you want to talk to how do you discover that? You're not seeing that in 1984, are you?
No. So Night of the Comet, for those that don't know, is a film from 1984 about two sisters who end up being survivors of an apocalyptic event. A comet passes over Earth, Halley's Comet, in fact, and kills everyone, fries everyone, turns them to red dust. Some people were only slightly affected and they turned into zombies. So it's these two sisters in the end of the world situation fighting zombies. Some people from the government have survived and government come after them to try and get something from their blood because they survived. So I actually love this film. When I first saw it, I think it was on Channel 4. It was probably in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
When I saw it on Channel 4. And I was up real late. It was probably a Friday night. And it's when they used to have announcers, and the announcer said, next up is Night of the Comet, the story of blah, blah, just what I said. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. So, you know, I thought I'd just watch it as I'm falling asleep. Ended up watching it all the way through and then becoming obsessed with it straight away because it is one of the best written. It has the best written dialogue like I've ever seen in a movie. It's very, very fast paced dialogue, and it's just funny as well. And it's wish fulfillment like all these post apocalyptic films. And the mix of comedy and horror is something you'll see throughout my three choices. It's something like I really, really, really desperately love. And the central characters played by Catherine Mary Stewart and Kelly Maroney, they just really appeal to me, like those two sisters. And they because they do the things that normally you don't see in these kind of post-apocalyptic movies, which is they don't straight away go off chasing zombies and killing them and going on these big adventures. They go to the mall and raid the mall and try on clothes and dance. The girls just want to have fun, which is what I would do. So I just love it. And then, you know, in recent years, I've befriended pretty much the entire cast and the director. And yeah, I've got to hang out with Kelly Maroney, Catherine Mary Stewart a bunch of times. And, you know, it's really fun to just have my favorite, because it's my favorite film of all time. Just every now and again, I get a text from Catherine Mary Stewart, just with a picture of her with Kelly saying, "We're thinking of you." And it just feels really good. It's really surreal.
That is surreal. I mean, for a zombie film, a zombie infection type film, it's really interesting how, and it's Tom Eberhard, isn't it? You pronounce it.
Yes.
That's the director of the film. Eberhard. He went on to do Honey, I Blew Up the Kids, is most notable, I suppose.
He did. Yes, he did.
So what I thought was really interesting about Night of the Comet, well, what I think is interesting about Night of the Comet is, obviously, like you say, you've got the two sisters and they're kind of, there's two very different storylines in the opening 10 minutes. I mean, I'm pretty sure the production budget didn't get to that many extras. So what they used for the Night of the Comet is brilliant. The way they mixed that kind of archive footage. But then the first zombie we see is, I mean, I think we can spoil a 1984 film.
Yeah.
The first zombie is the guy from the cinema opens the door and we're just confronted with a zombie. Like there's no if, no buts.
Yeah.
And there's not hundreds of them. It's just one wielding a monkey wrench.
Yeah, the rules of the zombies in this are interesting because they have an element of intelligence and some rudimentary speech as well. And then when they get to the mall, there's zombies there who.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Can actually speak like normally, essentially. And that zombie, the first zombie you see in the alley, he's called the Alley Zombie. He is iconic. He's on a lot of the artwork. And in fact, in The Walking Dead, there was one episode where you see him because whoever the director was at the time loves like Night of the Comet. So put that zombie dressed like that in an episode, which I thought was great. And I've spoken to like the director, Tommy Bahart, a bunch of times. We're pen pals now. He sends me film recommendations because a lot of these were, it's like a 50s throwback, like a lot of things from the 80s. It's a 30-year cycle and it's a throwback to those 50s films of, you know, nuclear kind of explosions and fear. So he sends me like films to watch from the 50s and the 60s. So it's really, really cool.
No, it is, and it gets the humour out, and also as someone, oh, there we go. There's the first bell on us. Obviously, seeing lots of retro 80s stuff as someone that grew up in the 80s, going back to a film that is actually so quintessentially 80s, even though it's a disaster movie, you know, a nightmare dystopia that we get to see it through, it still is quintessentially an 80s movie, you know. I mean, right down, one thing I know, I mean, this is going to be, you know, and it's not, given your level of involvement with the film now, this isn't too far geeky, but I forget the actor's name, but one of the government officials, she's the one who administers the serum and takes the blood samples.
Mary Warrenoff.
Yeah, Mary Warrenoff. When you first see her in the bunker, she's wearing leg warmers for no reason no good reason other than it's the 80s.
Yeah. That's so funny. That is so funny. And like,
she's wearing a military boiler suit, but she's got leg warmers on. Like,
and she's, you know, she's ubiquitous in 80s movies. She's in Eating Raoul and Chopping Mall as well. Basically, plays the same character and everything. But she's great. Mm. The entire cast, Chakotay from Star Trek's in it as well. It's such a great fun movie. If you haven't seen it before, next year is its 40th anniversary, so. It's about time you checked it out.
Indeed. Well, moving 3 years up the 80s ladder to 1987 to a film that I think is up there with films I've seen the most on VHS, I think it's safe to say, would be Evil Dead 2. Do you want to talk to what that, where that is important in sort of your...
Evil Dead 2, I mean, it's one of the most important movies full stop. I mean, neither comes my favorite movie, but Evil Dead 2 is probably the most important in terms of me being a filmmaker, because it showed me that you could mix, and I saw Evil Dead 2 before Neither Comet, so it showed me you could do horror and comedy together, and it showed me you can have fun as well. And I didn't really know the story behind it when I first watched it as a kid, that, you know, and I didn't see Evil Dead 1 till way later, but, you know, the story of a group of friends going somewhere and making stuff together without any rules is kind of what I've been doing kind of in my film career as well.
And
one thing I didn't mention in the talk with Prano is that, like, I've spoken to Sam Raimi a lot, especially over the last 6 months, where me and him talk a lot. And he is, he teaches me a few things and he advises me on things as well. And just having that knowledge, you know, imparting that knowledge on me, and he's someone that I respect the most, my favorite director, is really important. And, you know, I can't, you know, I'm very, very lucky to have someone like Sam Raimi, like, being my mentor, which is crazy. But, like, it's important because, like, it's strange because it doesn't follow some of the rules of horror movies, because it's one of the few films where it's not a final girl, it's a final boy.
Yeah.
And we still empathize with that character. We still enjoy the process. And everyone's seen it, so you don't need me to sell it to you, but it's the story of a guy going to the cabin with his friends and his girlfriend. They read from a book called The Necronomicon, call forth the deadites, and it's essentially a siege movie in a cabin in the woods. And the mythology that Raimi kind of creates the Evil Dead still has reverberations now, because there's we get a new Evil Dead film shortly, and we have Ash vs. the Evil Dead TV show. There's video games. There's something about those films, those original trilogy, that people absolutely love. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who's been inspired to become a filmmaker from Sam Raimi. I'm sure there's most horror filmmakers saw what he did with those movies.
Yeah, I guess that when you say it like that, it's, I guess before sort of Rodriguez and Smith and Linklater in the early 90s, Sam Raimi was one of those outliers in terms of he did it himself first and did it where he was kind of learning as he went, just in the same way those guys were in the early 90s.
Yeah, exactly. And he wears his influences on his sleeve as well. That's another thing that I take from Raimi, like his slapstick Three Stooges influences. He doesn't care about putting that into a horror movie, even though some people it might be jarring. All of a sudden, there's a slapstick scene where the deadites are trying to poke out Ash's eyes, and he does the Three Stooges thing. It's it's an amazing trilogy of movies, one of the first VHSs that I bought my own money as well. So yeah, it's really important because I think it made me the filmmaker I am today. I'm trying to be.
If it's not too hard a question to sort of answer, where do you see the DNA of this film in your filmmaking? Where does it appear for you?
To me, it's like having humor in a quite a serious subject. Like even in the original Evil Dead, there is that's a little bit more serious. But he kind of walks the line of being serious subject with comedy. And like if you just look in a Host, it's funny. Host is funny, even though it's pretty bleak and it's pretty dark, the things that happen to these ladies, and they all kind of meet their demise, or so you think. So I love seeing humor in horror to give it some levity and to make it more realistic. Because I don't know about you, but in a scary situation, I'm one of those people who try and make people laugh. I try to kind of bring some levity into it, and that you see that in Host, and you see that in Evil Dead 2 as well. Raimi there's funny things happening, even though it's scary, and it's a guy like losing his girlfriend, it's losing his friends, horrible things happen.
No, it is, and I hadn't even thought about it until talking to you now, but in a way, Evil Dead 2 is very similar to, say, Desperado, in the sense of what was learnt in the first iteration became the next film, with the studio, with some studio input and stuff. It's like...
Well, yeah, that's what, Dash Cam was very influenced by Evil Dead 2, just the absolutely breakneck speed of, how we throw everything at you. It's, if Evil Dead 1 toast, then Evil Dead 2 is Dash Cam, essentially.
Fantastic. Well, look, third on your choice, we go back a year to 1986's Labyrinth, directed by Jim Henson and mm-hmm. written by Monty Python's Terry Jones. Mm-hmm. One of my favourite scripts, to be honest with you. I think it's a work of genius. But do you want to talk to how where that is impacting on you as an adult now?
Yeah. Well, Labyrinth is as you know, one of my favorite movies of all time. I don't think it will ever slip out of my top five. It's one of those films I used to come home from school and watch from VHS every single day, because it's one of those films that just has that sense of wonder that we don't get from films anymore.
Mm.
It's it's the classic hero's journey storyline. But for those that haven't seen Labyrinth, please watch it as soon as possible. It's about a 13-year-old girl who whose brother's taken by goblins into the labyrinth. She has to follow him in there and get to the goblin castle before the time runs out, where the goblin king is, he's pretty obsessed with her, is holding her little brother, Toby, and she encounters lots of crazy characters and traps along the way. And it's really kind of her journey of self-discovery and of growing up. And it's amazing. And Jim Henson and Jim Henson's Creature Shop are just my jam. And everything about this film just inspires me, especially working with creatures. And as you know, for Ghost, I've worked with Jim Henson's Creature Shop. And I'm going to continue to work with them in the future. And Labyrinth specifically is something that I speak to them a lot about. There's hardly anyone there at the Creature Shop who works on Labyrinth now. But in a few weeks, I am actually meeting someone who was one of the puppeteers on Labyrinth, which is really cool. But there is so much to talk about on this film. Like, obviously, David Bowie, I'm a big Bowie fan, and he's the Goblin King. The songs are incredible. That soundtrack is out of this world. I listen to it all the time. But, it's just creating believable three-dimensional characters out of foam and latex, rubber. It's incredible. Even the little worm, you know, the worm's called Monique. People don't know, but if you look at the Labyrinth wiki, that a worm is called Monique. It's actually a lady, weirdly. So yeah, there's stuff I'm still discovering about Labyrinth every day, and it's trying to capture that sense of wonder that Labyrinth gives me is something I try to do. And I mean, a lot of the times you can do that with puppets because it's kind of otherworldly, but yeah, just like that sense of adventure that you had in those mid-80s films, like Flight of the Navigator, Goonies, Explorers. We just don't have that anymore.
That kind of pure fantasy world, I mean, even like Ridley Scott's Legend.
Love Legend, yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, I can speak to being like there when, you know, when this come out. Mm-hmm. And the 80s being the kind of cynical decade that it was, mm-hmm. and David Bowie being this rock god, there was kind of skewered a lot of popular opinion at the time. Mm-hmm. But what's amazing is that the film has only grown in reputation over the years. Like, it's considered to be, I don't think it was like maligned or to any great degree, but I think its love for it has grown rather than there was absolute love for it. The same as Legend, I think, as well. I think both films were not what the 80s wanted in some senses. As much as you say we might have lost some wonder, but I think that might have been the last vestiges of that kind of wonder.
I think so, yeah. And, you know, especially with Legend, like the Tangerine Dream, one of those bands who did soundtracks that instilled a sense of wonder into the films that they did the soundtracks for. Mm. I'm obsessed with Tangerine Dream. I know there's two versions of the soundtrack of Legend, but the Tangerine Dream one's the one I love the most. If I can somehow capture some of that wonder and fantasy and you know, just the excitement of the unknown and all these adventures in my films, then that's what I want to do. In fact, I touched upon it in the talk with Prano, with a project I just finished and picture locked on that I'm doing for a particular streamer is very much a throwback to those films. Mm. So I try to instill that sense of wonder that there's gritty realism, which, and then moves into this world of wonder, very much the Labyrinth kind of format.
It's not quite as dark as say like a Time Bandits, which again has that kind of childlike wonder.
That's very cynical. That's extremely cynical.
I mean,
cynical.
The end of that film is proper nightmare stuff. You know, it's the opposite of any fairy tale in a way.
Whereas, I still love it though. I absolutely love it.
That's my favorite movie.
Yeah. Even though John Cleese has kind of gone off the boil a little bit in recent.
Well, no, I'm loving the art, not the artist. That's my approach to that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, just to geek out a little, rewatching Labyrinth before speaking to you, it was amazing to spot script stuff in there that I'd not seen before. So, for example, when she saves Ludo, I had not clocked the setup of it was his screaming bringing the stones to her that then obviously become the rocks. Become the rocks and obviously become the boulders. You know, the boulders and the rocks at the end I got, but that I'd missed. I must have missed every time that.
Really? Wow.
And it's just because obviously I'm thinking, I'm talking to you about it. I'm like watching it with a different brain. And suddenly I'm like, bloody hell, look, that's an amazing little, without any sort of hint of exposition, it's just like, I'm giving you a clue, watcher, I'm giving you a clue.
And how they make Ludo, who he doesn't say a single word, he just has noises, making him such a lovable character. That's only something that the Creature Shop can do and Jim Henson. And like all of those creatures, Hoggle as well. Like I remember like 10 years ago where Hoggle was found in an airport, lost property thing in an airport, and I contacted the airport to try and buy Hoggle because he was a mess. But you know, someone's bought him now and kind of fixed him up. But I love this film so much, I would buy Hoggle. But I want to see more from this world. I know some people would rather you don't touch things like Labyrinth, but it doesn't spoil the original to kind of make a sequel or to make some extra media based on the world of Labyrinth, because it's such a rich world and I want to get back into it. So if I have any, one of my missions is to do something Labyrinth inspired.
So can I mean, I know the time's up here, but just one last question because of something you said when we were talking about this. If you could be talking to the kid that come home from school and watch Labyrinth every day, how would you explain what you're doing right now? And having worked with, you know, worked with the Creature Workshop and everything, how do you explain that to that person?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to comprehend. Like now I'm like mates with my favorite director, Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
And I'm working with the Creature Shop. I don't know, but you know, like people tell me, people who I grew up with, people I went to school with, people who I worked with previously, they said, oh, like we always saw this in you. We knew this would happen because you were always talking about these things. So, but because I'm experiencing it myself, I don't necessarily appreciate it as much as I should. Not that I take it for granted, but because I'm just like living it, I think at some point when I stop working and I stop doing stuff, I look back and think, wow, I did a lot of the things that I really dreamed about when I was a kid. Like, they've all kind of come true. And even just like hosts, like when me and Rob first started making short films, our aim was to make a scary movie that people would like. And first film out of the gate, we got one of the scariest movies of all time. And you know, it's on a lot of lists of best horror movies of all time already that like without even, you know, waiting a decade, it's appreciated.
Yeah.
It's difficult to comprehend, and it's very surreal. And because most of it happened in lockdown, it's even more surreal because we didn't actually really experience any of the things that surround having a successful film, because we didn't have like a big premiere. It just dropped unceremoniously on Shudder, so we didn't really have stuff like that.
I did like your little anecdote about when you were talking to Prano about how, well, we can't show it in cinemas because it's only 56 minutes long, and then it becomes a hit and they go, can we show it in the cinemas please?
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, so that rule was what, made up for nothing?
It's made up for nothing. It's because I think people have a perceived value of a cinema ticket, and they expect, because of, we're just used to it, or being a cinema for a certain time. But you know, like, and cinemas are scared of changing things. But I doubt anyone's going to ask for their money back after watching Host. I doubt someone's going to go, oh, there should have been an extra 10 minutes. I want my money back. And if so, don't go watch a 56-minute movie. No one's got a gun to your head. No one's telling you to watch these films. But you know, like, it played around the world, Asia, Russia. Like, it played absolutely everywhere. And, you know, it resonated with a lot of people. So, and it's a found footage movie as well, which is crazy. And it's my favorite.
Yeah. You managed to, because I mean, yes. Having covered Fright Fest a lot, I've watched a lot of found footage films, you know, and there's a quality spectrum which goes far and wide, and it's doesn't always hit the good side of the quality spectrum, because you can see it's just a cheap way of making a film, as opposed to, the found footage is the reason to make the film, if you know what I mean. The story is driving, the story of the found footage is driving the film, as opposed to sticking a camera on someone's head.
Well, it's weird. There really is a thing where it's every 10 years, a found footage film comes along, or every 7 years or something, a found footage film comes along that kind of breaks out. And, you know, it's Blair Witch and Wreck, Paranormal Activity. And then I think Host was the next one.
Yeah. Because in between those years, I was surprised that, say, like The Conspiracy didn't get to break out a bit more. I thought that was a super smart one.
Yes, for sure. And that's one of the other things that have come out of all of this. Like, now I'm mates with Eduardo Sanchez, the director, writer of Blair Witch Project, and we're working together on stuff. Yeah, and like I'm allowed to say, because he said it first on Twitter, that we're trying to get a Blair Witch TV show together. And we've talked about it. He's told me what he wants from like the pilot episode. He's told me who he's already got to be in it. We just need a greenlit, and obviously, you know, it's the studio that owns the rights to the Blair Witch Project, not Eduardo. So I'm gonna keep trying to work with my favorite people since I was a kid, and that's the beauty of being
I love the fact that talking to you now, it hasn't changed your relationship to the source material either. I think that's a really powerful message from this conversation, is that you've kind of enjoyed the films as a fan, and then you've got to look under the bonnet with the people that made it, and it's only made it more exciting.
Yeah, and I am 100% a fan first and a filmmaker second. I just love horror movies. And I was being truthful when I said in that Q&A with Prano that I carry around a piece of the Blair Witch House everywhere I go as a good luck charm. So I just always have that in my jacket pocket or my jean pocket, because it's my connection to like a film where if that film hadn't happened, Host wouldn't have happened. So, and I kind of owe everything to Host. So, you know,
I mean, I've been working with the producer Keith Bell, who did like, you know, did Dog Soldiers, The Descent, Harry Brown, and his advice, or it's not his advice as such, but his sort of pick me up whenever I'm sort of feeling a bit kind of, it's not going right, of this, that, and the other. He says, you know, the important thing is the only thing we define is our taste, which is what we curate our lives through, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what makes us, that's hopefully what translates into making whatever we make interesting, because it's a fusion, whether we're conscious or subconscious of it.
Yeah.
And nobody can take that away from you because you've already done it.
the only thing that can take it away from you is if, say, for example, you're writing to somebody else's idea of what a film should be. For instance, if people listen to critics, for instance, we would never have any good art, because critics have their own opinion, and usually all of critics kind of mush into one opinion of what's the right thing for films to be at that time. So this is why I say, for as long as possible, keep your 9-to-5 job if you are a filmmaker, because it will give you a safety net where you're not relying on trying to please people. You are only relying on your imagination, and that should have no limits. So, I personally think, do not try and lean into trends. Do not do what you think the critics will like. That is a one-way road to disaster. Write what you like, because you're the one who's going to have to live with this film forever. So if you're writing to what other people like, then you're just going to not like that film. Like, I'm always thinking of me looking back when I'm an old man in a nursing home or something. I want to look back and think, oh, that, I can't believe we got away with that. I can't believe we made that film. Because all my favorite filmmakers just make the films that have their unique signature in it.
I mean, this is not a scientific proof of any of this, but my two of my favourite films are Ridley Scott's The Counselor and Nicholas Winding Refn's Only God Forgives.
Okay.
If you go on Amazon and look at the results of what people have bought it, they have the same curve of like star ratings, where 25% of viewers give it 5, and then it curves into sort of nearly nothing when you get into like 3 stars, and then it butts out and it's like 40-odd% of people have said 1 star. And I think maybe that's the films that I like are the ones where there's a strong opinion both ways. It's not like,
oh yeah, my favorite type of movies are the ones who have like 50% of Rotten Tomatoes, but a real strong curve, like loads of the 5s, loads of 1s, because I'm just like, wow, like what is,
because it's got a reaction, hasn't it? It's managed to poke the hornet's nest in your imagination, whether that be for good or for bad.
The worst rating you could get is just everyone saying 3 or 2.5, because what's the point of making a film like that? Like, what I'm trying to do is make an exciting film that I would want to watch and stuff that isn't out there. Because if you're following trends, like by the time you make the film, that trend will be over. So you always have to think of what's next, or what's next for you, and what you want to see next.
Well, look, sir, I'm sure we could talk about the state of horror genre for as long as there's breath in our voices. But I won't make you do that. I'll just thank you very much for sharing your three films that impacted everything in adult life. And cool. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Cheers, Stuart. Appreciate it, mate.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.